I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Today, it's the latest installment of Battleground 2020, our monthly look at how the presidential election is playing out in Pennsylvania, which was a true battleground in 2016. Today, the battle is favoring Vice President Biden over President Trump, which we will talk about a bit later in the show. This Thursday, Vice President Pence is hosting a Cops for Trump event in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, which is in Westmoreland County in western PA, that went for Trump in a big way 4 years ago. We asked Lucy Perkins, a reporter and producer for WESA in Pittsburgh, to join us. She's been doing a series for the station, Split Ticket, profiling four Pennsylvanians on a host of issues that affect all of us, things like the protests, the pandemic, fracking and climate change, health care, and where they get their news. Lucy Perkins, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's get a snapshot, a very snapshot of these four people. Savannah Henry is a student. Tell us a bit about her.
Right. So Savannah is a rising junior at the University of Pittsburgh. She is the head of the university's Planned Parenthood Club. She's, you know, has a lot of progressive values. She's for reproductive rights. She was a big Bernie Sanders supporter and still is a big fan of his, even though he's no longer really a contender for the Democratic nomination. But she's from Erie. She is a woman of color, and she is kind of representative of these progressive values that we're seeing a lot in the city of Pittsburgh itself right now.
Linda Bishop is another person that you are following. Tell us about her.
Yeah, so Linda is in her 60s. She's retired, and she lives outside of Pittsburgh. She lives in Mars, Pennsylvania. And she's one of the women that I think a lot of people following kind of the postmortems of the 2016 presidential election heard about for the first time. She started grassroots organizing after the 2016 election, as a lot of women in suburbs did in Pennsylvania that we read about. Kind of has a purple voting history, she says. She voted for Republican. She's been a registered Republican, independent, Democrat, and is a more moderate voter and is a fan of Joe Biden.
Mary Henze is the third person you're profiling. Tell us about Mary.
Yeah. Mary is another really interesting voter. She is an Obama-Trump voter. She was a Democrat for decades and voted for Obama when he first ran, and then when Trump ran in 2016, she really liked his personality and the energy that he was bringing to the race, and she said she felt hopeful by his campaign, so she registered as a Republican and voted for him. She's in her 50s. She kind of lives southwest of the city of Pittsburgh in a small municipality called Jefferson Hills, and she is a hardcore Trump voter. She is unemployed right now. She's been on disability for about a decade. But she really supports Trump's stances on almost everything aside from cutting, you know, social safety net programs that she relies on, like disability and like Medicare.
And the fourth person you're following is a guy named Ed Zwicklinski. Tell us about Ed.
Ed is fiscally conservative. He's a little bit jaded. He is skeptical of Republicans and Democrats in Washington, but he's a Trump supporter as well and has been a Republican all his life. Is kind of more traditional in his values and is more steady in his values than someone like Mary, who kind of has flipped from one party to the other. He's for small government. He is anti-abortion. He, you know, is pro Second Amendment, things like that. And he really likes Trump a lot, too. He first saw him at a rally in 2015, I believe, and was, you know, equally captivated as Mary by Trump's personality and charisma and energy that he brought to the campaign then.
As I mentioned, you've been following them really since the start of the year and using them, I guess, as a stand-in for everyone who lives in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Unfair, of course. How engaged are they, would you say, in this presidential race? And I think what complicates it is, of course, the pandemic and all the fallout from the pandemic.
That's a great question. Yeah, I've been following them for, Well, I started following them before Trump was impeached in December by the House. So I've been following them for a long time now. And I do want to put in the caveat that, you know, yes, they are meant to stand in for various voting blocks, but they don't represent how everybody's feeling. It's just sure. a useful way to kind of grab the overall mood of a region. And so their engagement was really varied. Linda has been, when I kind of introduced her a little while ago, she's been engaged basically since Trump was elected. And was paying attention before that too. But she's been very involved. She's retired. She says, you know, she has the time to do this work. She is calling her lawmakers and writing letters and, you know, organizing where she can. And Savannah Henry was doing that too. She, since the pandemic hit, has been quarantining at home with her mom in Erie, so she's been less able to do organizing work, but she's still, you know, really invested. She requested her vote by mail ballot, you know, long before the deadline came and went in Pittsburgh. And so both of those voters voted by mail and they're paying attention to what's happening. Interestingly, the Republicans didn't vote in the primary. They really? Not for lack of interest in President Trump, but Mary had a health related event that so she couldn't get to the polls, but she had planned to vote in person because she doesn't trust the mail-in process. And Ed doesn't trust the mail-in process either, but he was unable to register to vote. He voted in another state in 2016 where he was living and had moved here a couple years ago and realized he didn't have all the paperwork that the state requires to register in time.
That's so fascinating.
They both, I know, yeah. So they both are. I wouldn't say they're any less adamant about their support for the president. They're still ardent supporters, but they haven't been doing the same level of grassroots organizing that I would say the Democrats have been.
It's interesting to think of them, Mary Hensy, Obama supporter, now a Trump supporter. I know I've said that before. But Savannah Henry was a Sanders supporter, and now she's a Biden supporter. What happened with her?
Yeah, she was kind of always on the fence after Sanders dropped out. She was really disappointed when he did so. And she just wasn't sure she'd be able to vote for Biden. She feels that he's a really moderate candidate and doesn't stand for a lot of or is not progressive enough on a lot of the issues that she feels so strongly about, like climate change, like reproductive rights, things like that. But what happened is when, you know, the protests over the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis kind of spread across the country when they were happening in Pittsburgh and across Pennsylvania, too, she was incredibly disappointed with President Trump's response to those protests. And that is what really kind of pushed her to say, you know what, there are things I disagree with Joe Biden on, but it's really important for me that we have a Democratic administration in place in the fall. So that's why she chose to vote for him. And I think a lot of that, too, you know, she's a young woman of color and has personally felt distrust of police for a long time. And so this issue really resonated with her. And that's kind of the thing that flipped for her, the switch that flipped that pushed her toward the Biden campaign.
You also looked at where they get their news and I guess in many ways sort of how the news shapes their views. And I guess not surprisingly, the two people who support Donald Trump get their news from Fox. They get it from Rush Limbaugh, from the people who support the Democrats or Joe Biden, MSNBC, and interestingly, NPR. But we see them lining up in those two lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do. And that is a story that I did very early on in the series. It was my second story just because I found that where you're reading your news really informs how you feel about certain issues. Not surprisingly, sources like Fox and some more conservative outlets kind of have similar talking points. And so, you know, when I would talk to the Republican voters about a particular issue like energy and the environment or reopening or things like that, they often kind of echo one another. And I've often wondered if that's because of the messages that they are hearing from this kind of united front that they're hearing from on conservative media. But it definitely, you're right, it definitely really shapes people's views. I don't think the Democratic or Republican voters I'm talking to have had their minds changed by the outlets that they're reading. They are finding the news that kind of aligns with their own beliefs.
Which is not surprising. I think that's
right.
That's that confirmation bias that I think is so so apparent. Let me ask you just a bit about the Conor Lamb race. And this was a race that got a fair amount of attention a couple of years ago. It's kind of complicated because of how the map was redrawn. But he was he's a moderate Democrat, as I understand it. And he's up against someone who seems almost more Trump than Trump.
Yeah, so Lamb is running in the 17th district, which includes some Allegheny County suburbs right outside Pittsburgh, as well as a much redder county, Beaver County, to the north of the city. And you're right, he beat Keith Rossis in 2018 by like 13 percentage points, so about 40,000 votes. But his Republican challenger this time around is definitely a Trump supporter. I think that could be an understatement. His name's Sean Parnell. He is a decorated veteran. He's an author. He's a mortgage consultant. He actually, his campaign was kicked off by President Trump himself. Trump came to an oil and gas conference for executives here in Pittsburgh last fall and announced that Parnell would be running against Lamb. And for a while, we were, you know, wondering what this race would shape up to look like. And Parnell, you know, published some pretty outstanding fundraising numbers for this past quarter. He outraised Lamb. He was one of, you know, I want to say about two dozen at most Republican challengers who outraised the Democratic incumbent in swing districts. He outraised him by more than $250,000. So Lamb still has a lead, but Parnell is closing that cash gap, which of course is really important when you want to buy ads and push voters one way or another. But what's interesting about this is, you know, it is a moderate district, and Parnell's strategy so far has been really hitching his wagon to the Trump campaign and echoing a lot of Trump's messaging when it comes to race and policing and the coronavirus and things like that.
Lucy, we're almost out of time here, but I just wanted to give you a chance to just tell our listeners briefly about Greensburg, PA. This is Westmoreland County. It did go for President Trump or candidate Trump in 2016, and that's where Vice President Pence is hosting an event, Cops for Trump. What do we need to know about Greensburg in, I guess, 30 seconds or less? Go ahead. Sorry
well,
about
you
that.
Kind of you summed up the its political background and where it lies in the state pretty well. I would say, you know, the notable thing here is we have seen Pence come out to Western Pennsylvania a couple times now. We haven't seen Trump do so. Trump's kind of moved toward other parts of the state. And so it will be interesting to see whether President Trump comes here on a campaign stop and when Joe Biden does as well. Because obviously, as we've been talking about, it's a pretty important voting block in the state of Pennsylvania in 2020. So we'll see what happens.
Absolutely. Lucy Perkins, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She's a reporter and producer for WESA in Pittsburgh. Check out her series called Split Ticket. And we'll be talking about the fact, or maybe asking the question, is Pennsylvania still a battleground state? We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowane. This is Battleground 2020, our monthly look on Radio Times at how this year's presidential race is playing out in Pennsylvania. Donald Trump surprised, even shocked, the pundits in 2016 when he beat Hillary Clinton by 44,000 votes, giving him the Commonwealth's coveted 20 electoral college votes. And frankly, the keys to the White House. What a difference 4 years can make. President Trump's popularity in Pennsylvania has taken a hit since his administration's handling of the pandemic and the Black Lives Matter protests. Although polls are a snapshot in time and anything can happen in the next 14 weeks, the Fox News poll shows Vice President Biden beating Trump by 11 points in Pennsylvania. The Monmouth poll puts him ahead by 13. And just today, a morning consult poll puts Biden ahead of Trump by 8 points. states 50 to 42. Today we want to dig into those numbers, what they reveal about voter engagement, the issues that Pennsylvanians care about, political and regional divisions within the state, and how the Democratic Party is wrestling with their ideological disagreements. And we have two guests who have joined us. Mark Nevins is a partner at the Dover Group, which is a political consulting firm. Mark Nevins, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be back, Marty. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. I should say he joins us by Skype. And Thea Rio Francos joins us as well. She's an assistant professor of political science at Providence College. And Thea, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation. Mark, let me start with you just briefly, but Thea, I want to get you in on this as well. Is Pennsylvania still a battleground state? I know 3 or 4 months ago, before the pandemic, all the conventional wisdom was this race for either Biden or Trump was going to be won or lost in Pennsylvania. Can we still say that?
I think absolutely, and I think it would be a mistake for anybody to assume that Pennsylvania is a foregone conclusion for either side. It has been a battleground state for the last 2 decades or more. Mm-hmm. It has always been a challenge. Democrats won it 2000 through 2016 in every presidential race. But clearly there is a path for Republicans to win. You know, you can look at Senator Toomey, you can look at even Senator Santorum and Republicans winning statewide, you know, over the last 20 years consistently. So this is a purple state to the core, and I think Democrats especially will make a mistake if they look at these recent poll results and think that they've got this in the bag.
Thea, how do you see where we stand today? And of course, it should be said that polls are always a snapshot in time. The election is 14 weeks from today, but how do you see where Pennsylvania stands?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with what Mark just said. I think that Pennsylvania is a battleground state because of the way in which sort of partisan divides within the state mirror national partisan divides. But I do think there are some key indicators that should probably make Biden's team more confident in terms of some of the specific voters that look like they're leaning towards Biden. And a lot of those are voters that lean Trump but had previously voted Democratic, right? So we have white working class voters, which there was a lot of discussion about in the wake of 2016, but also older voters and also suburban voters. And those key constituencies look like they're leading Biden, and especially the last two are very reliable voters. So, you know, I don't think a campaign should ever be overconfident, but some of the voters that you'd want, you know, coming out for you look like they will be in Pennsylvania, particularly, and in the country writ large.
Mark, I'm looking at the Morning Consult, which just came out today, and I don't want to spend, obviously, the rest of our conversation talking about polls, but they did find, and I'm quoting here, a potentially significant shift among independents who favored Biden by 12 percentage points, 46 to 34. Independents, one assumes these are people who can be persuaded one way or the other. What should we make of this?
Well, that's, you know, where elections are won is in the middle, and you know, it's easy to see the battle for base energy as a determinant in elections, but and it is important, but elections are won by persuading more people in the middle, and independents are the battleground in a battleground state. So if the Biden campaign is performing well among independents, that's an encouraging sign. It means that, you know, people who are traditionally undecided or who perhaps even split their ballot between Democrats and Republicans are feeling positive about the Biden campaign. But again, you know, taking any of that for granted or not putting in the work they need to put in Pennsylvania will certainly allow that to erode. And, you know, I think for me, the key indicator in this election will be what happens in northeastern Pennsylvania, in specifically Luzerne and Lackawanna counties, which for my money is where Secretary Clinton lost the election in 2016.
Thea, one thing you said to producer John Ahrens in preparation for the show, you said the Republican Party is good at winning without being popular. And I wrote that down because I thought it was provocative. And I want to just dig a little deeper in that. Why do you think that is? And what is it about their ability to win over people without, as you say, being popular?
Well, I think that we're seeing increasingly over time, but especially in this moment of pandemic and economic crisis, that the Republican Party doesn't put forward policies that address ordinary people's needs. Right now we see that in the infighting in the party over whether to extend this unemployment benefit that's obviously helped millions of Americans. I think that when you're a political party whose policies are increasingly unpopular and that appeal to an increasingly narrow base and have to do that base play that, you know, that Mark was just referring to, really drum up the faithful rather than expand, then you have to use methods of winning or of staying in power that I would call undemocratic. You know, we can see that with everything from gerrymandering, but we also see it in our institutions in the U.S. that aren't very democratic, whether it's the Senate, whether it's the Electoral College. We have a lot of what political scientists call counter-majoritarian institutions in the U.S., and those can ensure that parties or politicians that don't have majority support, and we need to look no further than President Trump, who did not win the popular vote, can get into office and stay in office. So Republicans have to increasingly rely on those types of tools as their policies drift away from the ideological center of the nation and from addressing kind of ordinary people's well-being and needs.
Mark, let me put to you sort of a related question, but it is interesting. It seems that progressives, left-leaning Democrats have really moved Joe Biden a little bit to the left. Medicare for all, fracking, Green New Deal, living wage, free college, social justice and politics. Not saying that there's agreement on all, but it seems as if, and perhaps coming from the Bernie Sanders faction, are still putting pressure on Biden.
Sure. I think it would be impossible to have participated in the primary election process for the Democrats this year and not at least take away some lesson from the fact that there were a number of highly progressive left wing of the Democratic Party candidates who were very successful and very popular. Senator Sanders, Senator Warren, and you go on down the line with all the progressive candidates who were running. But at his core, Senator Biden, Vice President Biden, is a moderate, and he's going to have to figure out where he's comfortable sort of sharing the platform with, you know, the sort of progressive wing of the party. I think he's open to having that conversation. Certainly that's a departure from President Trump's leadership style that's extremely my way or the highway. I think Vice President Biden is looking for ways he can find common ground with the progressive wing of the party to make sure that the platform that he offers is as diverse as possible. But I think that the key to winning those independents and expanding his base rather than contracting it is to make the platform as broad as possible, to make it as inclusive as possible for as many voters as possible.
Thea, let me ask you about climate change and fracking, and this is of importance to Pennsylvanians, especially in the western part of the state where there is a fair amount of fracking and related industries going on. And it, in certain ways, pits labor, that might be overstating it a bit, but certainly puts labor on one side and environmentalists on the other. Do you think, and focusing on Pennsylvania, that this is going to be a tough issue for Biden to try to figure out that middle ground, if there is one?
Yeah, I think it all depends on how he frames it. And I'm actually cautiously hopeful based on his new climate plan, which was very much influenced by the Unity Task Force and the kind of dynamics that Mark was just referring to. So we have a plan that promises to invest $2 trillion in 4 years for rapid decarbonization of the energy sector and target frontline and disadvantaged communities. And that shows kind of the influence of the left. But I think to answer your question directly, it's the way that he is linking jobs and climate to sort of make the climate change change issue, not an issue that's antithetical to jobs, but actually an issue where we can see a lot of job growth in a lot of green sectors of the economy, right? And so I think making that connection for voters kind of eases that tension, supposed tension between labor and environmentalists. And in Pennsylvania in particular, we've seen a lot of interesting movement in public opinion polls. So over the past couple months, there have been some new polls around fracking, and voters are starting to weigh the environmental issue more than the job creation issue. And I think, especially with the crisis in the fossil fuel industry right now, putting lots of fossil fuel workers out of work, it's not looking like a reliable source of revenue or of jobs in states like Pennsylvania, Ohio, or Texas.
Mark, you want to weigh in on that just briefly? I should add, I did a little bit of research last night. I think there's a little bit more than 30,000 jobs in Pennsylvania related to fracking. And then, of course, there are the jobs related to those particular jobs. And these are, relatively speaking, relatively well-paid jobs. How do you see this issue, Mark?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting, too, because I obviously look at this from a political perspective and probably a more practical perspective. And in 2016, I think President Trump was able to use this issue to his advantage. And he made a lot of promises about how coal was going to come back and we were going to reopen all these new coal plants and there was going to be all this new mining and the industrial sector of Pennsylvania would come roaring back to life. None of that has actually happened. And so he has lost, I think, the sort of high ground on this issue, because while there may still be some people who hear what he has to say and they just want to believe it, so they're willing to suspend their disbelief, I think for a lot of people, they're going to hear him talking about his support for coal or his support for fracking, but look around and wonder if they're really better off than they were 4 years ago. And some of that issue then loses its relevance or its traction for him.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Mark Nevins. He's a partner at the Dover Group. That's a political communications firm based in Philly, right, Mark?
Yes.
Okay. That wasn't on my little sheet here. Theo Rio Francos is an assistant professor of political science at Providence College. Let me read a couple of comments just to add to our conversation here. We've got Mike from Germantown. He said, I don't think people are enthusiastic about either Biden or Trump and will probably vote with their pocketbook. I also believe that voters may be embarrassed to admit they are supporting Trump, and so the polls may not be accurate. An email from Dave from Dresher. I travel a lot through Pennsylvania for work on I see a lot of Trump enthusiasm. I see zero Biden enthusiasm. An email from Paul. It's almost as if neither side wants to win. Biden keeps going to the left while the average Democratic voter is more centrist. And every time Trump makes some gain, he puts out some stupid tweets. An email. This is from a different Paul. When are the debates? If Biden slips up, gets a date or word wrong, can they derail him? Let me just give you, just a chance to respond to some of the what people are observing as they travel the state and just not feeling the enthusiasm for either candidates, or in the case of one of our listeners, seeing more enthusiasm for Trump than for Biden.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to kind of have those visual kind of indicators of enthusiasm when we're in the midst of a pandemic. People are socially isolated. Campaign rallies, which certainly Trump relies on a lot. Biden's probably, you know, less of a rally type. But even so, you know, you can't really hold those types of events. That being said, I think that we have seen really, really promising numbers on turnout in recent Democratic primaries in New York, in Pennsylvania, in Texas, elsewhere in the country. So it looks like Democrats are turning out for down ballot races, for smaller races, and we know that general elections tend to get even higher turnout. So I'm not, you know, I hear that Mark is concerned, you know, and is pragmatic. I'm less concerned about turnout because Democrats have been very angry right now about Trump's handling of this, and anger can, and you know, the pocketbook issue as well, as one of the listeners pointed out, can really drive people to the polls. And I want to just say one other comment, because the listener said it and Mark also said it. I think it's important to clarify that independents are not always centrist, and I think that gets conflated. The political science research shows that independents can have views all over the place, including in the fringes, right? So it's not always clear that in order to win independents or swing voters that you need to go to the center. I think that's a context-dependent decision, and we've seen a lot of really amazing left-insurgent electoral campaigns win from Pennsylvania, Texas, and New York, just to mention those three states that I referred to in terms of turnout.
Mark, let me ask you about Biden and how his, I'm putting campaigning in quotes, I mean, in many ways because of the pandemic, but it also seems as if the Biden campaign has made a calculated decision, which is essentially to let President Trump defeat himself. First of all, do you see it that way? Is that a winning strategy? And at some point, you know, they're going to have to go head to head.
Well, certainly there will be a point at which they go head to head. There's an old political axiom that says when your opponent is running toward a cliff, don't get in the way. And I suspect that that is part of what is driving the Biden campaign's strategy at this point. The more President Trump talks, the more he does, the more he says, the less popular he gets, and the better Vice President Biden does. So at this point, if you can conserve your resources, if your opponent is defeating themselves, then you can sort of take that path for as long as it works. Obviously, at some point there will be debates, there will be head-to-head conflicts over issues. But for now, it's a strategy that's working for Vice President Biden.
Do you think, and I've seen this several times, Mark, do you think there is a secret Trump vote that's just not showing up in these polls?
I do, and I think Thea was right that there are, and we saw this in 2016, there are people who will not admit to voting for President Trump, even in an anonymous survey. However, I think what's happening right now is that President Trump is winning an increasing share of a decreasing market. He is getting more and more of his base, which is getting smaller and smaller. So you are seeing a great deal of enthusiasm for President Trump, but it's among a shrinking part of the electorate. And that is, whether you're in business or in politics, a surefire way to go bankrupt.
I do want to pick up on that, and I do just want to quickly reintroduce you and tell our listeners that you're listening to Battleground 2020. It's a monthly series we're doing this year on Radio Times, taking a look at how the presidential race is playing out in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. That's Mark Nevins, Thea Rio-Francos joining us as well. And you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times Battleground 2020, how the presidential race is playing out in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, the polls, the issues, the regional divisions. Talking with Mark Nevins, he's a partner at the Dover Group, a political communications firm based in Philadelphia. Thea Rio-Francos is an assistant professor of political science at Providence College, and you can join us. There's a lot of speculation about who Vice President Biden might pick for his running mate. Interested in who you think would be good for him here in the state or the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Theo, there's been a lot of, will he, won't he, speculation about who the vice president might pick. He's made it pretty clear that he's interested in picking a woman. Maybe, probably even an African-American woman. First of all, how important do you think, especially this year in 2020, where it seems that, everything is up for grabs, how important do you think this decision is this year, and how important do you think it is for Pennsylvania?
Well, I'll let Mark take the Pennsylvania part of that question. But, I think that it is, though I did live in Philadelphia for seven years. But
I know, I was going to add
I'm
that.
I'm currently working in PA politics.
Right. No, there is a reason you're here. Yep, go ahead.
Yeah. But, you know, I do think that, that this is a decision that matters more to some constituencies than others. I mean, I think that, you know, there are women and people of color, of course, for whom representational, kind of symbolic, what's called symbolic representation is extremely important. We also see that, that for some of those same demographics, though, having someone that they feel represents their interests, whether economic or otherwise, is also important, right? So I think it's key to not kind of simplify voters or what they want. I definitely think that in this moment of, you know, mass uprisings over racial justice and against police violence, it would be strategic for Biden to choose someone, you know, a person of color, a woman of color in particular, and I can see why he wants to do that. But some of the women that he seems to be considering, I'm not sure on a sort of ideological level really speak to that moment. So it's kind of an interesting thing where you do sometimes get a bifurcation between what someone represents on an identity level and what their actual politics are. And I'm curious how he's going to juggle that, whether he's going to go for someone that's progressive and speaks to that moment, or go for someone who symbolically on an identity level connects with voters for whom that's important.
I mean, Mark, it is interesting to look at Pennsylvania. I would say a very male representative group of elected officials, whether we're talking about the governor. I don't believe we've ever had a female governor. We've got two men who represent the Commonwealth in the Senate. Men more dominate in the congressional delegation, also in the legislature. So how do you think a woman and a woman of color fits, especially Democratic politics in Pennsylvania?
Yes, statewide in Pennsylvania, we've been definitely slow on diversifying our representation, both by gender and by race. Very few women elected statewide, and aside from perhaps a statewide judge or two, I'm not sure we've elected a person of color statewide either. So it's not a state that embraces diversity in a practical way. I think that for Vice President Biden, there are a few factors at play, and Thea touched on a few of them. You know, there is the demographic profile of the person he chooses, a woman, a person of color. Where are they from on the map, and how does that help bring in votes in other parts of the country? You know, does the person need to be from the South or the Midwest or maybe the Southwest, you know, in the southwestern part of the country? There's also the political component. You know, where do they fit on the political spectrum? Are they ideologically progressive? Are they sort of moderate but left-leaning? But I think the third thing that often gets overlooked and is probably equally important to the other two, if not more so, is how comfortable is the candidate with the vice presidential running mate? And I think that's something voters, whether they realize it or not, can sense whether or not the people running together are actually partners. You know, I think President Clinton and Vice President Gore in 1992, for example, or Obama and Biden. But by contrast, I think that, you know, Senator McCain and I'm forgetting her name. Oh, Sarah Palin.
Hillary Clinton? No, no, no.
No, no. Yeah, no, I'm just thinking of Senator McCain and Sarah Palin. I'm not sure people ever really felt like the two of them were really on the same page. And I think it negatively affected Senator McCain's sort of core values and the way people perceived him on the campaign trail to have this person who was not necessarily sort of the same sort of political brand as he was. So I do think that whether or not the person that the vice president is considering is someone that he feels a kinship with is an important consideration for him, because he's going to be on the campaign trail with this person. And also his experience with President Obama, they were close. They were friends. They had a relationship that was based both in sort of political views, but also in sort of a personal, you know, a fondness for each other.
Let me toss something else out here, Thea. I'll send this to you. This was in Politico today by Holly Otterbein, who wrote that several hundred delegates to the Democratic convention are basically going to hold the line at Medicare for All, saying that they will not support the party if it doesn't come up with a Medicare for All as part of its platform. Do you think this is significant? Does this tell us that there's kind of a reservoir of Bernie Sanders supporters who just are not ready to sign on to Joe Biden? Do we have Thea?
For him, and I think, hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Thea. Sorry.
Hi. It doesn't tell us that they won't vote for him, and I think it's a myth that Bernie voters won't vote for Biden or didn't vote for Hillary for that matter. But I do think it shows that they want to exercise their ideological leverage within the party in ways that have been to some extent successful. And Mark mentioned this, and I mentioned this, that we already see Biden being influenced by the left of the party by pragmatic need to make sure that he holds the party together. We've also seen, though, at the same time that the establishment, you know, as it's referred to, is still powerful, right? So the DNC mm-hmm. platform committee voted to reject Medicare for All, voted to reject the legalization of marijuana at a moment where we have historic uprisings against policing and of course the war on drugs is a major component of that. So we see that, you know, there are still tensions within the party and ways that some of the party establishment might be out of step with some of where the energy among voters is. So, you know, I think it's a good tactic to exercise that leverage because as Mark himself said, like Biden is responsive to that, not to a point, but we've actually gotten more out of some of his campaign promises thus far than we would have if, you know, the Bernie left had not sort of exercised their power as a constituency.
Thea, here's a question from Dennis says, what is the upside or downside for Biden if he refuses to debate Trump unless he releases, meaning Trump releases his taxes? Do you think this, I mean, I don't know if that's part of Biden's repertoire, but do you think there he has some leverage there and that he might use it that way?
I think it's so hard to tell what works with Trump and what doesn't. I mean, it would just be such an odd ending to this whole campaign season to not have any debates between them, right? Like we had this year-long primary that was extremely contentious, but also engaged tons of voters, and, you know, dominated the headlines. And now we have a general election that, as some of the listeners pointed out, feels like it's not even visible to the ordinary person, right? And to sort of end without any debates, coming up on election day would be, you know, times keep getting weirder, so maybe that will happen, but it would be a very anticlimactic kind of end to what's been an extremely drawn out campaign season.
Mark, let me toss something that one of my colleagues at WHYY, Katie Meyer, wrote. It was a big piece headlined, Pennsylvania is becoming more racially diverse, and that could be a big deal for the 2020 election. And she looked at Northeast Pennsylvania that you referenced to Hazleton and the fact that you've got more Latinos who are moving into that part of the state. How important do you think that is, politically speaking?
I think it can be a game changer, not only in this upcoming election, but in elections for the next decade or more, because these are residents who are looking for a government that at least understands their challenges and perhaps even looks a little bit more like they do. And that's not exactly what we have right now. So yeah, they have the potential to make tremendous change. I think the challenge is that we have to make sure that those folks are registering to vote, and then we have to make sure that those folks are turning out to vote, because people who have just moved here or people who have immigrated here from other countries are not always quick to want to participate in the process. And I think we need to make sure that there's a stronger effort. I mean, I'd say we as a party, Democrats, need to make sure we're doing everything we can to get those folks registered and participating. Because once they get started participating in the process, it's easier to get them to continue to participate in the process.
Thea, it looks like if the election were held today, and it is 14 weeks from today, I mean, it does look like the president would lose a second term, and there is concern, and I'm curious whether you share this, that he if he loses, he will not give up power. And whether you share that concern, and if you do, how would he hold on to his job if he lost?
I don't think I'm concerned that he would not step down from power, but I am concerned that he will propagate a message of sort of conspiracy, deep state conspiracy, that will be appealing to his base, and that can have dangerous consequences. We've seen over the past several years upticks in far-right extremist violence. We're also in a moment where there's a broad protest movement, which itself has been a target not only of police violence, but also of folks that are against the protests, inflicting violence on protesters. So I think that those messages, even if they won't keep him in power, can have real ramifications and create forms of danger and violence for marginalized communities and social justice activists and all of those who the right seeks to target.
Pennsylvania, as we know, Mark Nevins has gone more for mail-in ballots. That was a big decision made by the legislature. It had a bit of a dry run with the primary just a month or so ago. And yet the president is doing everything he can to say that mail-in voting is fraudulent, everything that I have read, all the and this was true for other kinds of voting as well. There is almost zero fraudulent voting in this country, no matter how you do it. How do you see this issue, especially in Pennsylvania?
Right. It's ironic that he objects to mail-in voting as a person who actually mails in his vote.
Right.
but leaving that aside, you know, we're what's unique about this year's election, both the primary and the general, is that there is this no excuse absentee or mail-in voting mm-hmm. opportunity for people for the first time ever. And under normal circumstances, we as Democrats, and I'm sure Republicans as well, would have, and also organizations, you know, progressive groups, conservative groups, labor organizations, would have organized people to go out and educate voters on the rules for requesting a mail-in ballot. They would have been knocking on doors to make sure people got their ballot. They would be helping people submit their ballot, making sure that they didn't miss deadlines. There would be a real push to educate and assist people with the process. But this global pandemic has prevented anybody from being able to actually execute that kind of program. So we've got this first-time election opportunity, and it's happening in the midst of not only a global pandemic, but also, you know, significant social unrest in urban centers and even sort of suburban communities, and it's thrown the whole process into a great deal of uncertainty. So while there is this opportunity, it's unclear to me exactly how it's going to play out. I don't know how many people will participate. I don't know how many people will request ballots, and then also how many people will turn them in. Yeah. So it creates for us in the sort of election industry, it creates a real challenge as far as how to not only persuade voters, but when to persuade them and how many of them will show up and how they're going to vote. It's a very sort of fluid election cycle this year.
Yeah, we're almost out of time here. Final question. I think it was Ronald Reagan who asked, you know, are you better off today than you were, you know, 4 years ago or whatever. Does that question still relevant today?
Absolutely. I mean, voters often vote retrospectively, right? They vote based on, you know, how they can connect the past few years of their own, you know, lived experience with whoever's in office. And I think that there are a few voters in this country that feel better off. And the ones that feel better off are the 1%, are, you know, people that have benefited from Trump's giveaways to corporate America and tax breaks for the rich. So those people feel like they're better off, but they're the vast minority of the population. Most people are suffering right now, and the Republican Party and Trump is doing absolutely nothing to alleviate that suffering, or, you know, to even pretend to alleviate so that, you know, people might think that they would. And so I think that it's a losing strategy. And, you know, so I might be a little more confident than Mark about Trump's chances being very poor.
Well, Well, I appreciate you both joining us on Radio Times, our Battleground 2020 series. Thea Riofrancos, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And she's an assistant professor of political science at Providence College. Used to live in Philadelphia, I should add. Mark Nevins, partner at the Dover Group, which is a political communications firm which is based in Philadelphia. Mark, thanks for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me again, Marty. I enjoyed it.
Us as well. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.